Tibetan Sage by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 9. We left what was called the four-dimension room and crossed the huge hall to the one which was marked this world. The walk was about a quarter of a mile, so our feet were quite aching by the time we got to this world. The Lama, Mignar Dondup, entered and sat on the bench next to the console. I followed him and sat down on the bench beside him. The Lama touched a button, and the light in the room disappeared. Instead, we could see our world in the dim, dim lighting. I looked away, wondering what had happened, where was the light? And then I looked at the globe of the world and promptly fell backwards over the bench, hitting my head on the hard floor. As I had looked into the world, I saw a hideous dinosaur with jaws agape, and it was looking straight at me from a distance of about 6 feet. I rather sheepishly picked myself up, ashamed that I had been frightened by a creature which had been dead 1,000 years. The Lama said, "We have to skim through some of the history, because there is so much in the history books which is absolutely incorrect. Look." On the world I saw a range of mountains, and at the foot of one of the mountains there was a great horde of soldiers and their camp followers, which included many women. In those days, it seems, the soldiery could not do without the consolation of women's bodies, so the women went to war with them, so they could satisfy the men after a victory. If there was no victory, the women were captured by the enemy and used for precisely the same purpose as they would have been used if their side had been victorious. There was a very busy scene. Men were milling around quite a collection of elephants, and one man was standing on the broad back of an elephant, arguing with the crowd below. "I tell you, these elephants will not cross the mountains where there is snow. They are used to heat. They cannot survive in the cold weather. In addition, how are we going to get the tons and tons of food which these elephants would need? I suggest that we unload the elephants and put the loads on horses, native to the area. That is the only way we shall get across." Well, the commotion went on. They were like a lot of old fishwives, arguing and waving their arms, but the elephant man had his way. The elephants were unloaded, and all the horses in the district were rounded up, in spite of the protests of the farmers to whom they belonged. Of course, I did not understand a word of the speech, but this particular instrument, which the Lama had just put on my head, put all the knowledge of what was being said into my head instead of going by way of my ears, so I was able to follow everything in the most minute detail. At last, the immense cavalcade was ready, and the women were also put on horses. It is not generally realized that women are really much stronger physically than men. I suppose that they pretended to be weak, because in that way men carried the loads and the women rode on ponies. The cavalcade started off up the mountain path, and as we progressed upwards, we could see that there was no hope at all of getting the elephants up the narrow, rocky path. The Lama Mingyar Dondup skipped a few centuries, and then, when he stopped the spinning, we saw there was a battle going on. We did not know where it was, but they seemed to be pretty bloody. It was not enough to stick a sword into a person. The victor used to cut off the head of the victim, and the heads were all tossed in a great pile. We watched for a bit to see all these men killing each other, and they were flying pennants, and there was hoarse cries, and at the sides of the battlefield the women watched from roughly made tents. It did not matter much to them which side won, because they would be used for the same purpose. But they watched, I suppose, out of more or less idle curiosity, the same as we were watching. A touch of the knob and the world spun faster. The Lama stopped it every so often, and it seemed utterly incredible to me that each time he stopped, there seemed to be a war in progress. We moved on until we came to the time of the Crusaders, which the Lama had told me about. It was the thing in those days for men of title to go abroad and make war against the Saracens. The Saracens were a gentle, cultured race, but they were still quite prepared to defend their homeland, and many an English title ended on the battlefield. At last, we saw the Boer War in progress. Both sides were utterly convinced of the justice of their case, and the Boers seemed to have a particular target, not the heart, not the stomach, but lower, so that if a man was wounded, and if he was able to get home somehow, he would certainly be of no use to his wife. All this was explained to me in a whisper. Then, all of a sudden, the battle ended. It seemed that both sides were either the winners or the losers, because they intermingled, and then at last the invaders, the Crusaders, moved to one side of the battlefield, while the Saracens moved to the opposite side, where they too had women waiting for them. The wounded and the dying were left where they had fallen. There was nothing else that could be done. There was no medical service, so if a man was badly wounded, he often asked his friends to put him out of his misery, and how they did that was to put a dagger in the man's hand and then move away. If the man really wanted to end his life, he merely had to push the dagger into his heart. The world spun on, and then there came a ferocious war which seemed to engulf most of the world. There were people of all colors fighting and using weapons, great guns on wheels, and in the air, at the end of ropes, there were things which I now know were called balloons. They were up high, so that a man in a basket attached to the balloon could peer over the enemy's lines and try to figure out how they would attack or how they should be attacked. Then we saw some noisy machines come flying through the air, and they shot at the balloons and brought them down in flames. The ground was an absolute morass of mud and blood, and there were bits of humans all over the place. There were dead bodies suspended from barbed wire, and every so often there came a crump, 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 and great lumps would come flying through the air, which, when they hit the ground, exploded with quite disastrous results to the countryside as well as to the enemy. A touch of a button and the picture shifted. We were looking at the sea, and we could see dots so far away that they indeed looked like dots. But the lama, Mingyar Dondup, brought them into a closer focus, and then we saw that they were huge metal vessels with long metal tubes which moved to and fro and spewed out great missiles. The missiles traveled 20 miles or more before falling on an enemy ship. We saw one battleship. It must have been hit in the armament section, because we saw the missile land on the deck, and then it was as if the world exploded. The vessel heaved and burst into 1,000 parts. There were flying bits of metal all over the place, and flying bits of humans. And with all that blood coming down, it seemed as if a red fog was settling over the place. At last, some sort of arrangement seemed to come into force, because the soldiers stopped shooting at each other. We, from our vantage point, saw one man surreptitiously raise his weapon and shoot his commanding officer. The Lama Mingyar Dondup quickly pressed a few buttons, and we were back in the area of the Trojan Wars. I whispered, "Master, aren't we jumping from date to date without any regard of the sequence?" "Oh, but I'm showing you all this for a special reason," Lobsang. "Look," he pointed. A Trojan soldier suddenly brought his spear to the level, and it went straight through the heart of his commanding officer. "I was just showing you that human nature doesn't change. It goes on and on like this. You get a man, he will shoot his commanding officer, and then perhaps in another reincarnation, he comes and does precisely the same thing again. I am trying to teach you certain things, Lobsang. Not to teach you history as from a book, because those historical books are far too often altered to suit the political leaders of the time." We sat there on our bench, and the Lama tuned us in to many different scenes. Sometimes there would be 600 years between scenes. That certainly gave one an opportunity to judge what the politicos were really doing. We saw empires rise by errant treachery, and we saw empires fall again by errant treachery. The Lama suddenly said, "Now, Lobsang, here we will have a glimpse into the future." The globe darkened, lightened, and darkened again, and we saw strange sights. We saw a great liner, as big as a city. It was steaming along like a queen of the seas, and all of a sudden there was a heart-wrenching screech as the ship was sliced open below the waterline by a projection from a mighty iceberg. The ship started to settle. There was a certain amount of panic. A lot of people got in lifeboats. Others fell into the sea as the ship listed, and on one deck the band played to avert panic. The band played on until the ship went down with a frightening gurgle. Great bubbles of air came up and great gouts of oil. Then, gradually, odd items came up as well. The dead body of a child, a woman's handbag was somehow floated to the surface. This, Lob sang, is another item which is out of its chronological order. This should have come before the war you have just recently seen. But never mind, you can flip through a picture book and perhaps get as much knowledge as if you read everything in that book in the right order. I am trying to get certain things into your head. The dawn broke. The early morning sunlight glinted redly on the tips of the icebergs and spread downwards as the sun rose higher. As it spread downwards, it lost its red color and became the ordinary, normal light of day. The sea was littered with an absolute incredible collection of items. Broken chairs and various parcels and, of course, inevitably, the dead bodies, white and waxy. There were men, or what had been men, in evening dress. There were women, or what had been women, also in evening dress, but which could better be described as evening undress. We looked, and we looked, and there was no rescue ships in sight. And, as the Lama said, well, Lob sang, we will move on to something else, and there is no point in us loitering here when there is not a thing that we can do. He put his hand to the buttons and to the knob which was on the end of a little rod, and the globe spun faster. Daylight, darkness, darkness, daylight, and so on, and then we stopped. We were in a place called England, and my guide translated some of the names for me. Piccadilly, Statue of Eros, and all sorts of things like that. And then he stopped, right in front of a newspaper seller. Of course, we were quite invisible to the man, because we were in a different time zone. What we were seeing now was what was yet to happen. We were glimpsing into the future. We were at the beginning of a century, but we were seeing something either 1939 or 1940. I could not quite make out the figures, not that it matters. But there were great placards about. The Lama read them out to me. They were about someone called Neville Chamberlain going to Berlin with his umbrella. And then we slipped into what the Lama called a news theater. On a screen we saw grim-faced men in steel helmets and accoutred with all the instruments of war. They were marching in a most peculiar way. The goose step, said the Lama, practiced by a lot of the German army. And then the picture changed to show starving people in another part of the world, people who just dropped dead of hunger and cold. We moved out into the street and skipped a few days, and then the Lama stopped the spinning for us to catch our breath, etc., because skimming around the world through various eras of time was indeed quite a disturbing and exhausting experience, especially for me, a boy who had never been out of his own country, who had never seen things with wheels before. Yes, it was quite a disturbing thing. I turned to the Lama Mingyar Dandup and said, "Master, this matter of Patra, I have never heard of the place before. I have never heard of any of the teachers mentioned Patra. They teach us that when we leave this earth through the period of transition, we go to the astral world, and there we live until the urge comes to us to go back to earth in a different body, or to go to some other world in a different body. But nobody has said anything about Patra, and I am really confused." "My dear," Lobsang, "there are many things of which you have not yet heard, but will. Patra is a world. It is a far superior world to this one and to the astral world. It is a world to which people go when they have some very special virtues, or when they have done a very great deal of good for others. It is not mentioned because it would be too discouraging. Many are chosen as possible material for Patra, and then at the last moment the person shows some weakness or some wrongness of thought, and so he loses his chance of going to Patra. You and I," Lobsang, "are quite definitely assured of going to Patra as soon as we leave this world. But that is not the end of it, because we shall live in Patra for a time, and then we shall go on to an even higher place. On Patra, you see people who have devoted their time to research for the good of man and animals, not for man alone, mind you, but for the animal world as well. Animals have souls, and they progress or fail to progress just the same as humans do. Humans too often think that they're the lords of creation and that an animal is just there for the use of man. They could not be more mistaken." "Well, Master, you were showing me what war was like, a war that had lasted for years. Now I would like to see what happened, how it ended." "All right, then," said the Lama, "we will go to the time just before the ending of the war." He turned away from me and looked up some book with dates in it, and then he set the controls on the console, and the simulacrum of our world came to life again, came to life with plenty of light. We saw a shattered countryside, and with rails upon which they ran certain machines which carried goods or passengers. On this particular occasion, there were what appeared to be some very ornate boxes on wheels. There were glass sides, and armed guards in great numbers patrolled all around. Then we saw servants putting out white cloths and covering tables, and dust covers were taken off various articles of furniture. Then there came a lull. I took the opportunity to pay a visit to see that my own nature was in working order, and when I returned, oh, a couple of minutes later, I saw what seemed to be a vast number of people. I thought they were in fancy dress, but then I realized that these were head soldiers and head sailors. It seemed to be representatives from all the countries at war. One set of people did not associate with the other set of people. At last, they were all arranged and sitting at tables in that box-like thing, which was some sort of vehicle. I looked at them, and of course I had never seen anything like this before. All the leading men decorated with medals attached. I immediately recognized that these were the high members of a government trying to impress the other side by the weight of metal on their chests and the number of ribbons around their necks. It really astonished me how they could hear each other speak because of the jingle-jangle of this metalware on their chests. There was much waving of hands, and messengers were kept busy taking notes from one man to another, or even to another part of the vehicles. Of course, I'd never seen a train before, and such a lot of it meant little to me at the time. Eventually, they produced a document, and it was passed from person to person, who each signed his name, and it really was most amazing, the different types of signature, the different types of writing. And it appeared perfectly obvious to me that in all truth, one side was no better than the other. That, Lob sang, has yet to come. This terrible war had been going on for several years, and they have now proposed and declared an armistice, under which each side returns to their own country and tries to build up their shattered economy. I looked and I stared, because there was no rejoicing here. Everyone was grim-faced, and the looks were not of joy that the battle had ended. The looks were of hatred, deadly hatred, which I could see from one side of the thoughts were, "All right, you win this round, we'll get you next time." The lama, Mingyar Dondop, kept on to the same time. We saw soldiers and sailors and airmen still fighting until a certain hour of a certain day came around. They were still at war until that day, and 11 o'clock appeared with, of course, the loss of countless lives. We saw a peaceful plane with red, white, and blue circles on it flying back to its base. It was 11:05, and then, from the clouds, there appeared a fighter plane, an evil-looking thing it was, too. It soared down out of the clouds and got right behind the red, white, and blue plane, and then the pilot pressed a button in front of him, and a stream of something came out of weapons and set the red, white, and blue plane on fire. It nosed downward in flames, and then there was one final splash and bang, and that murder was committed. It was murder because the war had ended. We saw great vessels upon the seas loaded with troops returning to their own countries. They were absolutely loaded, so many that some of the men had to sleep on deck. Some slept in lifeboats, but the ships were all going towards a very large country whose policies I could not understand, because, in the first case, they were selling weapons to both sides. And then, when eventually they joined in the war, well, they were fighting against their own weapons. I thought that this surely must be the depths of insanity. As the great ships reached the harbor, the whole place seemed to go wild with excitement. Skeins of paper were flung about as streamers. Cars were hooting and ships were hooting as well. And everywhere there was bands playing, no matter that some were playing one piece of music and another lot was playing another piece of music. The uproar was indescribable. Later, we saw what appeared to be one of the leaders of the victorious forces driving down a vast street with huge buildings on each side, and from all the floors of the buildings there came pelting paper confetti, paper ribbons, and all that type of thing. Various people were blowing hard on some sort of instrument which certainly could not be called a musical instrument. It seemed that there was a great celebration because now much profit would be made from the sale of ex-government weapons to other countries, smaller countries, who wanted to have a go at war with some neighbor. It was a dismal scene indeed which appeared on this world. The soldiers, sailors, and airmen had returned to their homeland, victorious, they thought. But now, well, what are they going to do for a living? There were millions of people out of work. There was no money, and many of them had to queue up and go to what they call a soup kitchen once a day. There they got some awful muck in a can, which they took home to share with their families. The outlook was grim indeed. In one country, ragged wretches could continue no longer. They were walking along on the sidewalks, peering at the space where the sidewalk became the pavement, the roadway. They were looking for a crust or anything, a cigarette butt, anything at all. And then they would stop and lean against perhaps one of the posts which carried wires, notices, or lights, and then they would slump to the ground and roll into the gutter, dead. Dead of starvation. Dead through loss of hope. Instead of sorrow from onlookers, there was gladness. Some more people had died. Surely there would be enough jobs soon. But no. These soup kitchens grew in number, and various uniformed people went about picking up the dead and putting them on a wagon to be taken away to be, I supposed, burnt or buried. We watched various items spread out over the years, and then in one country, we saw that they were preparing for war again, the country which lost last time. There were great preparations, youth movements, and all the rest of that. They got flying training by making quite a number of small aircraft and claiming that these were recreational things. We saw a very funny little man with a small mustache and pale, bulging eyes. Whenever he appeared and started ranting, then a crowd quickly collected. Things like this were going on all over the world, and in many cases, countries went to war. Eventually, There was a very big war in which most of the world was involved. Master, I said, I cannot understand how you can conjure up pictures of things which have not yet occurred. The Lama looked at me, and then he looked at the machine standing ready to show us more pictures. Well, Lobsang, actually there's nothing very difficult in it, because if you get a gang of people, you can just about bet all you have that when they do things, they will all do it in the same way. If a woman is being pursued by a man, she will run in one direction and hide. I vow that if that occurs a second and a third time, her path is established. And you are very sure then, when you predict, that there will be a fourth occasion and the woman will run to her secret hiding place, and that her tormentor will soon be caught. But, sir, I said, how is it possible to produce pictures of a thing that hasn't happened? Unfortunately, Lobsang, you are not old enough yet to be able to appreciate an explanation. But, briefly, corresponding things happen in the fourth dimension, and we get what is more or less an echo down here on the third dimension. Some people have the ability to see far ahead and to know exactly what is happening. I am one of those called a very sensitive clairvoyant and telepath, but you are going to surpass me many, many times because you have been trained like this almost before you were born. You have thought that your family have been hard on you. Yes, they have, very hard, but this was an order from the gods. You have a special task to do, and you had to be taught anything which could be useful to you. When you are older, you will understand about time tracks and different dimensions and all that sort of thing. I told you yesterday about crossing an imaginary line on the earth and finding that you were in a different day. That, of course, is an entirely artificial affair so that the countries of the world can trade and so they can have this artificial system where time is artificially varied. Lobsang, there is a point which you apparently have not noticed. The things we are seeing now and discussing now are things that will not happen until 50 years or so have passed. I was almost stunned when you told me that, Master, because at the time it seemed all natural, but yes, I can see now that some of the things, well, we don't have the science to do them, therefore it must be something in the future. The Lama nodded his head gravely and said, yes, in 1930 or 1940 or somewhere in between there, the Second World War will begin, and war will rage almost throughout the whole of the globe. It will absolutely ruin some countries, and the ones who win the war will lose the peace, and those who lose the war will win the peace. I cannot tell you when the war will actually start, because there is no point in knowing. Anyhow, we cannot do anything about it. But it should be round about 1939. and that is a good few years ahead yet. After that war, the Second Great War, there will be continuous guerrilla warfare, continuous strikes, and all the time the unions will be trying to increase their power and gain control of their countries. I'm sorry to tell you that in about 1985, some strange event will occur which will set the scene for the Third Great World War. That war will be between peoples of all nationalities and all colors, and it will bring the race of Tan into being. Rapes are terrible things, no doubt, but at least if a black man rapes a white woman, then we have yet another color, Tan, the race of Tan. We have to have a uniform color on this earth. That is one of the very necessary things before there can be much lasting peace. We cannot give exact dates, exact to the day, the hour, the minute, and second, as some idiots think we can. But we can say that around the year 2000, there will be intense activity in the universe and intense activity on this world. After a bitter, bitter struggle, the war will be resolved with help from people from outer space, people who do not like communism here. But now is the time to see if my legs are good enough to walk on and get down the mountainside, because then we must return to the Potala. We looked at all the machines we had used. We made sure they were clean and left in the best condition that we could manage. We made sure that all of the switches were working properly, and then the Lama, Mingyar Dandap, and I put on new robes. New robes, a million or more years old, and of wonderful material. We must have looked like two old washerwomen, if anybody could have seen us, poring over the clothes to find something which especially appealed to that amount of vanity which we still had within us. At last, we were satisfied. I was a monk, and Lama Mingyar Dandap was done up with a robe of very high status indeed, and I knew he was entitled to an even higher one. We found big robes which would fit over our new equipment, and so we put them on to save our clothes when going down the mountainside. We had a meal and a drink, and we said each goodbye to that little room with the hole in the corner, and then we set out. "Master," I exclaimed, "how are we going to hide the entrance?" Lobsang, "never doubt the powers that be. It is already arranged that when we leave this place, a curtain of solid stone, many feet thick, will slip down and cover the entrance and destroy any evidence of it from outside. So when we get out, we must hold our hands and rush. We must go as fast as we can together to get out before the big rock falls in place and seals away these secrets to prevent the Chinese finding them. Because, as I told you, the Chinese will take over this country, and Tibet will be no more. Instead, there will be a secret Tibet with the wisest of wise men living in caves and tunnels like this, and these men will teach the men and women of a new generation which will follow much later on, and which will bring peace to this earth. We traversed the path, and then we saw a square of daylight. We hurried along as fast as we could and shot out into the open air. I looked with love down at the Potala and down at Shakpuri, and then I looked at the steep way ahead of us, and I really wondered how we would manage. At that moment there was a tremendous commotion, as if the world was coming to an end. The rock door had fallen, and we could hardly believe our eyes. There was no trace of an opening, no trace of a path. It was as though this adventure had never been. And so we made our way down the mountainside, and I looked at my guide, and I thought of him going to die at the treacherous hands of communists, and I thought of my own death, which would occur in a foreign country. But then the Lama Mingyur Dandap and I would be united in sacred Patra. End of chapter 9 and epilogue. And so yet another true story has come to an end. Now there is nothing except to wait in my hospital bed until my silver cord be severed and my golden bowl be shattered, so that I can go to my spiritual home, Patra. There is so much I could have done. I would have liked, for instance, to have spoken in the League of Nations, or whatever they call themselves nowadays, on behalf of Tibet. But there was too much jealousy, too much spite, and the Dalai Lama was in a difficult position, taking aid from people so that, of course, he could not go against their wishes. I could have written more about Tibet, but here again there was jealousy and fake articles, and the press have always sought for anything gruesomely horrifying or what they call wicked, and which they do every day. Transmigration is true. It is an actual fact of life, and it used to be a great science indeed. It is like a man traveling by air to his destination, and then finding a car waiting for him as he steps out of the plane, only in this, a great spirit takes over a body, that he may do a task allotted to him. These books, my books, are true, absolutely true, and if you think that this particular book smacks of science fiction, you are wrong. The science in it could have been many times increased had the scientists been at all interested, but the fiction, there just isn't any, not even artist's license. So I lay back in my old hospital bed, waiting release from the long night of horror which is life on earth. My cats have been a relief and a joy, and I love them more than I love a human. Just a final word. Some people have tried to cash in on me already. Some people spread about the story that I was dead and that from the other side I had commanded them to start a correspondence course, that I, from the other side, would be the head of it and we would correspond with a Ouija board. Now, the Ouija board is absolute fakery and worse, because in some cases it can allow evil or mischievous entities to take possession of the person using the Ouija board. May the blessing of Buddha be upon each and every one of you and preserve you. The End. Tuesday, Lobsang, Rampa. End of Tibetan Sage.